What you're about to hear is a Dharma talk given by Venerable Karunadharma on Who Are You? Who Am I? This talk was given at the International Buddhist Meditation Center on February 12, 2006.
Several different levels on which we can speak about a person. For instance, if we speak about me, we could say, well, I'm a Caucasian female, age 65. My maternal grandfather's family came from England in 1629, 1 year before the Great Puritan Migration, in order to start what was later called the Massachusetts Bay Company. They wanted him to see if it was worthwhile going to the New World to do trading. But he ended up staying in the New World. He actually lived in Salem. He was a magistrate. Fortunately, he was not living in Salem at the time of the witch trials. He moved to an adjoining city, so he's not involved in the witch trials. In fact, you know, I've never wanted to find out which side my family was on because both sides are quite terrifying. You know? And then my maternal ancestors, my maternal grandfather came from Norway in the 1880s at the beginning of the Great Norwegian Emigration. And he moved into Wisconsin, and there he met my grandmother, and they eventually married, etc., etc. So we could talk about those less important things about who I am, or we can look at a little bit more deeply. Theistic religions, such as Christianity, when they try to figure out what somebody is, they will peel off all the layers of what is unimportant, such as all the information which I just gave you, to find out at the very end that there's a little bit of the divine left, which they call soul, or as the Vedic religions called Atman. But in Buddhism, when we do that, we come up with nothing remains. So that's what I want to look at today. The Buddha proclaimed the doctrine of Atman, no soul. Very frequently. On this particular point, he was quite adamant, saying that when a person died, nothing was left over. Well, if I do not have a soul, who am I then? I thought I'd explore this a little bit more today. The Buddha taught us that the human, in fact all sentient beings, are made up of five elements, which are called the skandhas, or a collection of collections. The first of these five skandhas is rupa, or body form. And our bodies are made up of four elements: solidity, fluidity, air movement, and heat. If any one of these stops functioning, the body dies. Solidity is found in bone, muscle, all those sorts of things. Fluidity is basically the things that flow through our body, such as blood, urine, things of that nature. And then the third factor is air movement. When we breathe in, we take in air. It goes into our lungs, and from there it's dispersed to other places and eventually ends up in the blood, which is what nourishes our cells. So that's the movement of air, of gases in our body. And the fourth factor is heat. Because when we eat food, that becomes transformed into calories. And those calories are what gives us heat. You all know these sorts of things. All these functions are necessary for our body to function. Stop one of them from working and the body dies. But then he goes on to state that there are four mental collections as well. The first of these four is Vedana, or sensation and the perception of sensation. The second is Samjna, or conceptualization. Because what we sense, we begin to think about. Then after that are the samskaras, or our volitional karmic habit patterns. And from my way of thinking, everything we do is volitional, except for autonomic things such as breathing. We can control the rate at which we breathe and how deeply we breathe, but we cannot control breathing itself. Because if we stop breathing, then we would end up dying within, well, the average person, I think, dies within about 15 minutes after they stop breathing. Some people, however, can live on quite a bit longer than that. But at any rate, that is the third function. And the last of the functions is vijnana, or consciousness. Now let's look at each of these individually. Vedana, or the perception of the sensations we receive, ordinarily does not occur just one at a time, because when we see a flower, we ordinarily not only see it, we can smell the odor of it, and we can almost feel it without touching it, and we can hear insects around it. So basically, we are utilizing all of our senses at the same time. And this is what Mahayana calls the five Vedana, or the five, the five Vijnanas, the sense consciousnesses. There's an eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, skin or feeling consciousness. And these five perceptual consciousnesses then become integrated together by the sixth consciousness, which we call, what is the word for mind here? Vimalshanti. No, manas. We call it manas. Or manovijnana, I'm sorry. We call it manovijnana. That means the consciousness that brings all the sense data together and tries to make sense of it. The seventh consciousness then is manas, which means mind. And the eighth consciousness is alyavijnana, or the storehouse consciousness. I left the seventh consciousness out of here for a reason. Because the first six consciousnesses are what we encounter on our external world. The alyavijnana is totally internal. You cannot see it, you cannot hear it, you cannot taste it, etc. It's totally an internal consciousness. And the seventh consciousness is just a bridge which puts us in contact between both the external and the internal consciousness. So that is very important, and that is where our concept of self arises. This is where we come up with our mistaken ideas of I have an identity, this is who I am. I have a soul, or I have an ego. That arises because of the interplay of both the external consciousnesses and the internal consciousness. So the seventh consciousness, in which we become very much messed up in, is basically just a bridge between the external world and the internal world. Everybody understand that? Okay. It's not so easy to understand if you don't know Buddhism fairly well, but I'm sure that all of you have enough understanding of Buddhism to understand what I'm saying. So then let us look at this in terms of paticca-samuppada, or as we call it in Sanskrit, paticca-samuppada. It's almost the same pronunciation. And this is basically the conditioned things, because in Buddhism, all things except nirvana itself or enlightenment itself are conditioned. They come about because of certain things. If you have this, then you get that. If you put this together with this, then you get that. Things of that nature. So if we look at the paticca-samuppada, then we can begin to see how our body and our consciousnesses become involved in this. There are 12 links to this chain of dependent origination, is another word for it, dependent origination. And that is the first step. You can start anywhere in this chain, but actually we usually start for convenience at the first one, which is called avijja, which is ignorance or delusion. The second one is samskara, or karmic formations. The third one is vijnana, or consciousness. The fourth is nama rupa, or mind matter, which is basically what we've just been talking about, mind and matter. The fifth one is salayatana. These are the sense bases. The sixth is pasha, or contact, or impression. The seventh is vedana, or the reactions that come to these contacts. From these reactions to these contacts, then we get a feeling of tanha, which means craving. Because once we contact something, we either say this is lovely or we say this is not good. It's either good or it's bad. Very rarely are things neutral, although they can be. So once we experience an experience which we classify as pleasurable, then we want to try it again and again, right? This is where our thirst comes in, tanha. It's translated as thirst. I think that's a very good word to describe this. Because whenever we touch something which we really like, we get a great thirst to have it occur again and again. It's like an uncontrollable thirst. And that is where we begin to build up our karma, right there. From the reactions to sensations. And then comes that thirst. That is where karma begins. After the thirst, then there becomes clinging, or as it is known as upadana. Upadana is clinging, grasping onto something. We have to have this. We won't let it go, etc. like that. From that then becomes bhava, or becoming. And from bhava then there's jati, or rebirth. And of course, once somebody is born, then there becomes old age, sickness, and death, jara marana. So this is basically how our karma works. Does anybody have a question so far? You all know what I'm talking about, right? Well, if we look at how then to end these, the formula for Paticca Samuppada is as follows. Avijja Paccaya Sankhara. Through ignorance are conditioned the sankharas. That is the rebirth producing karma formations. Samskara is the karmic formations. And why do we have those? Because of ignorance. If we didn't have ignorance, you wouldn't develop the samskaras. But because we are basically ignorant of the way life really works, that produces then in us these karma formations. Sankhara paccaya vijnana. Through the karma formations are conditioned consciousness. Once we have these karmic formations, then we gain this conditioned consciousness. Vijnana paccaya namarupa. Through consciousness are conditioned mind and matter. You see, these things we're talking right now about the order in which they ordinarily go to develop karma. Although you can also talk about them as being how one comes to rebirth. But I'm not speaking about it that way right now. Nama rupa paccaya salayatana. Through the physical and mental phenomena are conditioned the six bases of the senses. Salayatana paccaya paso. Through the six bases is conditioned impression. That is, means impressions that come from the senses. Because first of all, you have to have the senses, right, in order for the sensations to reach them. Pasya paccaya vedana. Through impression is conditioned feeling. Or that is, feeling, I don't like to use that word. This is what it used on the internet. But I like to use the instead of feeling, because to me that is always sort of a touchy-feeling thing. What they're really speaking about here is the reaction to these sense contacts. Not feelings, as in feeling something. That can also be meant emotional, which is why I don't like to use the word feeling at all, because I think it's very confusing to people. Is she talking about emotions or is she talking about physical feeling something? That's why I never use them. Vedana pachyatanha, through feeling, is conditioned craving. Tanha pachya upadana, through craving, is conditioned clinging. Once we crave something, then it very easily goes into wanting to hold on it, wanting to grasp it. Upadana pachya bhavo, through clinging, is conditioned the process of karmic formations and becoming. Then bhava pachya jati, through the process of karma formations, is conditioned rebirth. And of course, once you have rebirth, then what do you get?
Sickness, old age, and death.
Right, right. Sickness, old age, death. And then it goes on to lamentation, suffering, grief, and despair. Really makes us want to live, doesn't it? So those are basically the links of conditioned things. And if, you know, whenever we give a memorial service, we always have Venerable Shanti chant this part of the sutras. Because then he chants that list of how they come about, and then he chants how you get rid of them. So to get rid of them, you just run the opposite direction with them. So if that is who I am, who are you then? Because when we become enlightened, all that disappears. Then what is left over? Well, first of all, you ordinarily become enlightened in your lifetime. So if you are an enlightened person sitting here, are there any? I don't see any. But anyway.
Just Buddhists that don't know they're Buddhists.
So when you become enlightened, you still have your body, but you no longer desire things. You no longer try to avoid things. You live by the moment. And then when you die and the body breaks up, what is left over? Just pure enlightenment. Pure nirvana. That's all that's left over. The Theravadins describe these two nirvanas as nirvana with substrate, meaning nirvana with a body, and nirvana without substrate. Nirvana without a body. That's after death. Would you like to be enlightened?
Sure. Yes.
Someday.
Now. Do you want to be reborn back here?
No.
I don't believe you.
I wouldn't mind. I'm having a blast here.
Yeah, because we always say, oh, I want to become enlightened. I don't want to be reborn again. But I really don't think that people really sincerely want that. Because we cling to life so much. And when we die, I think probably most of us want to be reborn. Because of our ignorance, we think, oh, I'm having such a good time. This is really wonderful. I want to be reborn. But when you start to become older, and you start to get more aches and pains, and when you wake up in the morning and your back is so stiff you can barely move, then it doesn't seem quite so nice. But then you get up, you move around, your back works better and better. So then you forget what it was like when you first woke up in the morning, you know. So that's when you say, well, this life is not so bad. But to think of going through millions and millions of lives, going through the same process time after time after time, the details change, but that's all. Because our lives are all basically the same as each other, so only some details change in it. We all get caught up in particular desires. We all become deluded. We all want this. If I can only have this, I'll be happy. That is utter nonsense. Because our desire for things would never end. So once you got that wonderful job that you're looking for, after a while you say, gee, this job was not all it was cracked up to be. I thought I'd be very happy once I got this job. But after a while it seems unfulfilling. I have a theory as to why I think that is. Because when we work very hard for something, when we finally attain it, we feel let down because I think it's because we dream so often about attaining it. We have these imaginations in our mind as to what it would be like, and they never are that way. So that girl that you're so fascinated by, once you get her, within about a year or so, you're, Oh, God, she's not what she was when I married her. Of course she's not. Nobody is the same as when you married them. Because actually at that time you had an image in your mind as to what she or he would be like. And once you've lived with them for a while, that image is out the door. And, you know, because I believe that true love rarely happens. Because true love means putting the other person always in front of you. But most people marry because it fulfills a desire that they have. We have an image of what we're like. And anything that fulfills that image, whether it's a good image or a bad image, makes us happy. That's why you find so many miserable people who cannot change their lives because they are basically happy with the way they are. Maybe happy is not the right word. But yeah, they are sort of satisfied. But they're also caught in this bind of thinking, well, that's me. And so if they see themselves as being an unhappy, unfulfilled person, they're not happy unless you act that way toward them. So they go out of their way to make you act that way toward them. You all know people like that, I'm sure. And then there are those people who want to always be happy. They don't want anybody to think ill of them, which is totally a nonsense also. Because no matter who you are, somebody will like you and somebody will not like you. That is just the way it is in this world. Because each of us is the center of our own universe. There are a dozen or more universes right here in this room, probably about 15 universes. And each of you is the center of your own universe. Now, we get along quite well unless my universe abrades against Nam's universe. Then we look at each other and say, If only you could understand what I'm really saying, we'd get along. But you see, when my universe abrades against anybody else's universe, that causes problems. And so when your universe abrades against somebody else's universe, then you've got a problem. But these are universes which we made up. They're totally mind-created, and thought is not thought. Because we just created thought. Thought has no more reality than anything else. In fact, it has a lot less reality. But because we thought it, we think this has got to be true. If only he could understand my thinking. If only W could understand what he's really doing, he would stop doing it. Ain't gonna happen, guys. Because he is the center of his own universe. And he thinks that he knows what is right. Just like I'm the center of my own universe, and I think I know what is right. And it isn't the same vision of W. But that's why we have all these disagreements in life. Because we believe what we think. Very bad to do that. Thinking is what causes all of our problems. If we were an animal and weren't thinking, our lives would be much simpler. But animals do think. But I mean, you know, they deal with their exterior environment. They don't have to deal with the interior environment. At least most of them don't. One of my students claims that her bird is quite aware of its internal environment. Maybe he is. I don't know if Mango is or not, but I mean, you know. I know that he does run Mira's life. That is for sure. She tried to get him a girlfriend one time. Didn't work out. I said, Mira, he has a girlfriend. It's you. So anyways, we get caught up in our own thinking. We begin to think this is true, this is true, this is true. And none of it is true. In fact, there's no such thing as truth with a capital of T. All truth is relative. I know that the right-wing Christians would be very unhappy for me to say all truth is relative. But I have not yet seen any truth which stands by itself alone, except for enlightenment. That is the only totally non-conditioned thing. Because when you become enlightened, all the conditions which made you up have totally changed. And you no longer are who you were to begin with, but you still look the same. And people still think you are that person. But in reality, enlightenment is the only true reality. Okay, I think I'm through now. I think I've talked too much, in fact.